This episode is about minutes 26 through 30 of Solo, A Star Wars Story, featuring Ralph from Live Action Star Wars. Hello there, and welcome to Star Wars Music Minute, where we celebrate the music and sound of Star Wars 5 cinematic minutes at a time. I'm Chrysanthi Tan, but you can call me Xanthi, and today is all about minutes 26 through 30 of Solo, A Star Wars Story, which takes us from Han and Chewie looking over the mountains while, riding some transport, and ends with a campfire scene with Beckett, Val, Han, and Chewie talking about the future and this mission that they're about to tackle. I'm excited to have Ralph back to the show from Live Action Star Wars. We haven't spoken since The Last Jedi, so
yeah.
Thanks.
I'm excited
to talk to you about this set of minutes in particular, and also thank you for being like a listener and supporter of the show since the very beginning, first season.
I grew up a film score fan, so I love pretty much anything film score related. I even put out my solo album behind me. And I'm a huge John Powell fan. When this movie was announced, I mean, we'll get into the minutes real quick, that Ron Howard was going to do it, I was really anxious to see who was going to do the score. And when they announced it was John Powell, I was over the moon. I was so excited.
Say more.
So here's the thing. Ron Howard, I mean, listen, with Live Action Star Wars, I like to be a positive guy. And there's only one film composer that I really do not care for.
And let me jump
that
in here.
Composer.
Let me jump in here. Okay. So I'll just give some background. Ron Howard normally works with Hans Zimmer. That's his normal collaborator. And since he was brought on in the film, since he wasn't the original director for the film, John Powell had already been hired. Not knowing that when Ron Howard came onto the film, he has said in interviews that he called upon Zimmer and was like, "Hey, do you want to do a Star Wars?" And Hans Zimmer was like, "Yeah, for sure." And then Ron Howard found out that John Powell was already onto the project. So he had to like go back and say like, "Oh, we already have someone." And to his credit, Hans Zimmer was like, "Oh, John Powell will be great, and like you've got a good person on your hands." So,
John Powell used to work with Hans Zimmer.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm not going to get into it too much. One of my issues with Hans Zimmer is his process, and I'm not a big fan of his process. And what he does is he'll compose themes, maybe like 20 minutes worth of themes before the film is completed. And once the film is done, we'll get 5 or 6 other composers to come in, utilize those themes, and then score the picture. John Powell was one of those guys at one time and sort of was able to branch off and become, do his own thing. And so I followed John Powell for a while. I think the first time I heard him was in The Bourne Identity. And which is all his other scores are wildly different than Star Wars, except for maybe How to Train Your Dragon might have some of that stuff in there. But I knew when he got Solo, I was like, he's going to nail this. He's going to be able to get the feeling of Star Wars without sounding like a John Williams clone, which, there's no sense in trying to be John Williams because it's never going to sound right. So, when I found out it was John Powell, I'm like, okay, this is going to be a unique, different Star Wars score, but I know he's going to nail the tone. And I feel like he did. Mm-hmm. I feel like he did. I really like this score a lot.
Yeah. I'm excited about the work that was done on Solo. And I guess, we'll definitely be getting into specifics. So we can even just start listening to some of the beginning right now, or the beginning of these minutes. Does that sound good to you?
Yeah, okay. Definitely.
All right. So imagine a scene where we are easy. Well, I'll just play music and you'll probably be able to picture it. Okay, here we go. And
Thanks for helping me get out of there. No, they only took you because...
Does anything stand out to you about this?
Hey.
Like, there are a lot of things for me.
Sweet deal here.
Yeah, mostly the percussion.
Yeah.
It sounds very John Powell. Doesn't sound like Star Wars to me. Maybe once we got later on to like Mandalorian with Ludwig Göransson really pushing percussion. Like it doesn't seem like John Williams does have percussion, but it doesn't seem his main sort of focus. I feel like John Williams is more melodies. But that percussion is very, very John Powell. It sounds similar to like a How to Train Your Dragon. But the sort of sweeping strings, and I know you brought this up on Twitter recently, is flying music.
Yes.
And pardon me. What you might be able to tell me this, because I love flying music.
Mm-hmm.
The last time I went on a trip, I created a playlist of flying music. And there's something about it, and I don't know what it is, that just feels grand.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's doing that. Usually strings, lots of strings. And
okay.
Then maybe some brass. I don't know. You could describe it better. I don't know music that well. I just have been listening into it for a long time.
No, this is a fantastic conversation to get into because, well, first I want to address what you said about percussion because I think I hear what you are hearing in that there's something about the percussion that doesn't feel like classic, you know, as in what came before it, Star Wars.
Right.
And I would probably push back against like the idea that John Williams doesn't focus as much on percussion. I think it's,
right.
I think he writes percussion very differently is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
okay.
I think, I mean, I'm not necessarily right. I'm just giving my thoughts. I think what stands out to me about this percussion is it almost sounds more, it's more reminiscent of like pop music to me because of because it's more of a groove. It like settles into
right
a groove. Like, and with John Williams percussion, I tend to think of like, percussion being more, I don't know. I don't want to say orchestrally used, but like something about it tends to feel more like on A New Hope minutes, we've been talking about the Battle of Yavin. And so the percussion in that is like, dude, it's so all over the place. Like you couldn't just like pin it down for 10 seconds of doing the same thing basically.
Right.
And in this, it's like, do, like you can really groove along to it like for a couple minutes.
Yeah, I guess I mean like it feels like a more of a driving beat.
Yes.
Like it doesn't, like I feel like John Williams really doesn't do that in Star Wars.
Yeah.
He obviously uses percussion in like this when the Sand People are introduced in A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
And he does that sort of Planet of the Apes, Jerry Goldsmith like sound. But yeah, I was watching this scene and it's a pretty quiet scene and we get pretty much the tail end of the cue, from the minute prior. So the music kind of comes down a little bit, but do you think this would be a part of the movie that John Williams would have scored, or would he left it quiet and just leave the sounds to like Ben Burtt or whoever, Matthew Wood or whoever, to just have the wind go and have there be no music?
I think he absolutely would have scored it. I think he maybe would have scored it differently though, but I think if we look to John Williams's other sort of flying music or soaring music, which I consider there to be sort of a distinction between flying music and soaring music.
I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah. I think we can hear examples of him definitely evoking some sort of a grand sweeping type of score. The percussion might be different, but I think there is a sort of, it's a type of writing that feels less like underscore and more like it's going to be out in the open. And we do hear examples of that, like on Octo, which definitely different type of music, but John Williams definitely can do the soaring type of music where it's going to like, just listen, just think of E.T. when like, I don't know if there's any better flying, any better example than like the flying theme.
Did anybody bring that up in your tweet response?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
It didn't even occur to me to do that one, which is one of my favorites.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a moment in the E.T. theme that every single time I hear it sort of gives me goosebumps. It's not the normal, like, da, 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 na, 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 na. It's not that part. Mm-hmm. It's the...
Okay.
Oh,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Na, 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 na,
na. That part is so great.
Okay.
And it's...
Yeah. I know what you mean.
Anyway, like, and then the other one that I noticed some people posted and I was going to post was the flying music in Hook.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That one is
another
amazing.
John Williams score.
Yes. Yes. That one. And the thing that's great about that is the whole movie is slowly building this theme so that when Pan finally starts flying, it finally plays that theme in full. And so you get a real rise out of it. But I understand what you mean between flying and soaring.
Yes.
Because, and in fact, one of the posts that you did was Soarin' Over California.
Exactly.
By Jerry Goldsmith.
Which I'm going to play
amazing.
A little bit of.
Amazing. It's amazing. I love Jerry Goldsmith.
So
that's tops for me.
So let's talk more about flying versus soaring, because we've name dropped a lot of tracks right now, and I don't want to play all the examples for YouTube copyright reasons, but right. I do like they're all over cinema, because flying in general is just inherently like. It is a common theme that pops up in movies because it's like inspiring. It symbolizes so much. And plus, if you think about the era that movies were like happening when flying was more of a new thing, like flying just represents so much. And it's just the climax of so many movies. It's just all over cinema. So there's so many examples of this, like so many.
And I think that flying still captures everybody's imagination. So it's always has this like grand... sweeping sound that kind of lifts you up, makes you feel good.
I mean, flying literally, like, it adds an extra dimension to the like to the angle of what we can view. I mean, if we even think of like Attack of the Clones, like when we see traffic happening in the air, you know, on Coruscant, like I just remember like that just unlocked so much imagination for people. I mean, I'm sure even people who don't like the prequels, like. I don't know. It just like, like air traffic, like that, even thinking about like driving in that kind of situation, like it just becomes such an infinitely more complex matrix to navigate. Yeah. And so flying gives you that like height, which you are not only experiencing the world on a different level, but like you can also look down on it. And because of your position, you can see so much more. It's like a huge wide angle lens everywhere.
Yeah. Speaking of Attack of the Clones, like my favorite stuff from that movie is the Republic, the gunships that bring in the clones and the Jedi are flying in and holding on to the bars. And like, as they're flying through, like all of that stuff is super exciting. Like with Star Wars, space battles are fun, but they feel so abstract because I've never been to space. Mm-hmm. So when you see something flying that has where you can see like in the atmosphere above the clouds, in the clouds, where you can look down and see the earth below you, it feels more grounded and it feels more, for some reason, more fantastical than just a space battle.
Yeah,
I agree. It has a level of danger. Like you can fall.
Yeah, I mean, it's like flying in an airplane. I feel a little bit divorced from the fact that I'm flying, hurtling through the air. Yeah. But if I were in a helicopter or something, I would be like, oh my God, what?
I've been in a helicopter when I was around 10 or something. We went in a helicopter ride in the Grand Canyon, and I'll tell you right now, it's terrifying. It's so terrifying. But I think there should be some sort of playlist of like all of these flying tracks that
I started
that
making
should
one
be available. Okay, good.
But also someone also responded to my tweet saying that they also had a playlist. It seems like, I don't know, I kind of, for those listening, like, who didn't see this tweet that I made, how dare you? No, just you know, when I was like researching for the show and kind of just starting to think of ideas of things to talk about, and just getting interested in things I was listening to, a week or two ago, I tweeted, like, what are some examples of flying music in classical music or film scoring or like any kind of scoring, because I was starting to hear, like, as we were getting into these minutes where, you know, we have flying with Chewy, you know, this stuff.
Yeah.
This stuff. Something about it felt so familiar and inevitable to me. That I just knew that this must be like a huge topic, and it was. It was like a ton of people responded to this tweet with like examples of their favorite flying music or like what they consider good examples of flying music. And then that helped me like whittle it down, like, or narrow things down into categories, because I'll read some of the examples that people were saying. So one of them was from Return of the King, something Eagles. I confess, oh, I'm right. Not savvy with Lord of the Rings, so right. I just don't know that score very well. But a lot of people mentioned Lord of the Rings, Howard Shore's score.
Right.
And then
it's a big moment in the third film.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And then a lot of people, like, I can't emphasize this enough, brought up another John Powell score, How to Train Your Dragon. A lot of people mentioned, I think it's called Test Flight. Is that what it's called?
He might have, I think he won an Academy Award for that. I could be wrong.
Okay.
For that score. It's a really good. It's really good. And he's super proud of it. They've been touring How to Train Your Dragon.
That's cool. The
John Powell's music. So keep an eye out for that.
And then there's also, I'm just gonna read these, and maybe I'll make a playlist and throw a link in the show notes if I remember, or put links to like a lot of these tracks so you can hear. And then there's another John Powell one, Flying with Mother from How to Train Your Dragon 2. Okay. And then Man of Steel, first flight scene from Superman. And then
Hans Zimmer.
Yeah. And then there's Flying. Oh, no, that was a Beatles one. And then We're Going to Fly Now, which is James Newton Howard. Oh, that's, you said that.
It's me. I wrote that.
Yeah. Yeah. From the Green Lantern.
I try to put things off the beaten path. I didn't want to put anything, you know.
But actually, the examples that you tweeted back, which is why I reached out to you for this episode, was they were actually like, you were one of the first people that responded to the tweet too. And they kind of did help me start categorizing things into different things. And then
flying and soaring.
You said Bastion's Happy Flight from The Never Ending Story, which a few people said.
Okay.
And that one I think is a really good representation. Frank Lehman said, as far as John Williams goes, you have so many examples to choose from. It's ridiculous. E.T., the indie films, Superman, Amazing Stories, Empire of the Sun, Always, Hook, Jurassic Park, American Journey, AI, HP, Harry Potter films, probably more. People mentioned Buckbeak's Flight from Harry Potter. Howard Shore, Icarus. I mean, they're just so many good examples. And the thing that made me start to categorize things into either, shout out to Christopher Tin. This is not a film score, but someone shouted out Sogno. I don't speak Italian, so Sogno di Volare. Is a near perfect representation of flight, and Leonardo Dreams of His Flying Machine by Eric Whitaker. So anyway, the point is there's a ton of examples, and We were talking last week with Camilla, or I was talking last week with Camilla on the show about, we were starting to get, you know, we were getting into this flying sequence. So we kind of touched upon it. Mm-hmm. And so we talked a little bit about Soarin' Over California, like Soarin' the ride at Disneyland or Disney's California Adventure, Soarin'. And we also touched upon the difference between like zipping through space music. Like there's a difference mm-hmm. between flying, soaring, and being in space, if that makes sense, and Frank Lehman on Twitter, of course, film musicologist. Oh, and he's the guest next week. pointed me toward this paper in the Journal for the Society, Journal of the Society for Music Theory. And it's a paper by Sean Atkinson. And Sean Atkinson is not a listener of the show, but he wrote this paper that was an examination of called Soarin' Through the Sky. I'll put a link in the show notes because it's very interesting. And I think people who are interested in this topic would find this fascinating. It's called The Topics and Tropes in Video Game Music. And there are similarities in scoring, you know, scoring for film, scoring for video game, scoring for media mm-hmm. in general. So even though it's not exactly what this topic is about, he uses like Bastion's, he references Superman, he mm-hmm. references like the opening fanfare in the Spirit of St. Louis, he references E.T., he references Bastion's flight from the Neverending Story, he references Harry Potter. So like there's a lot of crossover. And so I read that paper last night and I should have honestly, like I wish I had read it a long time ago, although maybe not because it was interesting that I had some of the same hypotheses that he had a lot more in-depth, analysis on. And he does also talk about like this, this range from flying to soaring, like how there is sort of like different valences to those things. But what he finds as being sort of common in flying music are sort of like rapid arpeggiations. Like we're talking about and then a tendency to ascend in a melody, like, like do 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 do, like in some way going up.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and then there are certain harmonic qualities too. Like there are certain it's not present in this one, but there are maybe like in Superman or in some other things a tendency to go up in fourths and fifths, like. Like, I mean, if you just even think of the Star Wars main theme, like kind of goes, it kind of is like this heroic kind of sound. Obviously, so it depends on the type of film that you're scoring and like the type of mood that you're going from. But there are just, multiple large ascending leaps is a thing. Certain instruments are also a thing. Pushing the melody higher toward a cue is a thing. And so with these things in mind, maybe we can listen to this again and then compare it to Soarin', which is, I feel like it's the closest thing to this cue that I, out of all of these, like I think the closest thing is this Soarin' piece of music, which again is just the score for the ride, Soarin' Over California, or Soarin' Over the World, but... That's too much detail.
California was the one that Jerry Goldsmith scored.
Yes.
And then when Soarin' Over the World came along, he had already passed. Mm-hmm. And so I believe they, someone adapted, I don't know who, but adapted his music. But
it's Soarin' the same basic.
Over California. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the one.
Yeah, I agree. So, so let's listen to, this cue from Solo again, and pay attention to the drums, like the way that it grooves in a kind of repetitive pattern. The way that the strings kind of, I don't know, it feels the optimism of it, the pacing. Yeah. Did you want to add something?
I was going to say the optimism of it is. It's so key to this movie.
Yeah.
Because at this point, we haven't seen Han Solo fly yet. And so that's all he wants to do is fly. And so this is the first time we see him like
in the sky.
In the sky. And so John Powell like scores that to make it important and uplifting, and the whole galaxy is ahead of him now. He's not confined to a Lady Proxima or the Empire. He's out there. He's not, you know, trapped by the Imperial Army in the mud pit. He's been washed of all the mud, and he is now free. And so it's such like the fact that they put this scene in the air is perfect. It's perfect. So the music reflects that. And yeah, I'm excited to listen to it again.
Yeah. And also, I like that the way that you just put that, because I didn't really, you're right. We haven't seen Han Solo fly yet. And this is such this cue, it feels like it's just a taste of how he feels in the sky, which is, you know, happy. Like he feels good goosebumps. In the sky.
Yeah. It's goosebumps. I love it.
Yeah. All right. So. And then we hear that wind.
Thanks for helping me get out of there. No, they only took you because of me. Hey, I got us a real sweet deal here. We do this one job with them. We make some real money, and then we're
It's like
free.
The most optimistic sounding music I could think of for this.
That. Yeah.
I mean, it
feels like it would be music that you would hear at the end of a movie, at the end of a happy movie.
Yeah, it does.
But this is just the start of his story. Yeah, I don't know if the music even will get this grand again, like this joyful. I think once you get to the Falcon and he sits in the Falcon, that stuff is pretty uplifting and joyous,
but perhaps more active. This is less, yeah. This is more relaxed. And
yes,
and I think we do have we do experience a range of heroic, triumphant, happy, positive, optimistic in other parts of the score. But this, the relaxation of this, like is hard to find elsewhere, I think. So if we look at the chords, for example, this, the sort of structure of this, the chords are not changing very quickly. So we have this C major would be and harmonically speaking, this is a relatively simple cue. Like it's not one of those really complex ones with lots of weird chords in it. This is as pure as it gets. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like C, G, C, D, D, and then it's F, D, 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 D. So for those who people might recognize that as basically we have C, we have a tonic, we have a G, which is a dominant. We have an F, which is a subdominant. So if we we're looking at this in terms of functional harmony, which would mean assigning each chord a function number in terms of, so if we're in the key of C, C would be number one. That would be its function. It would be one, Roman numeral one, which would be also called the tonic. The most common leading chord up to that would be the five, which is called the dominant. So if you go just five up, C, D, E, F, G, that would be G. So that's why I call that the dominant. So if you think of that leading thing is the dominant. So the most common thing that leads to the dominant would be the subdominant, which would be the F. So that's exactly what we get. This is music theory class day one, when they're teaching you chord progressions that tend to work or whatever, chord progressions that you might see all over music. They're all right, first step, just learn tonic is where you is home base, and then do dominant to tonic, and then try subdominant to dominant to tonic. Like, this is like the just, it's so pure. It's very pure. Mm. Yeah. And it unravels over a long span. So like we have long notes, like just literally the notes are being held for a long time. Long time.
Yeah.
One. Like it's, this would be like relaxed to play. The conductor could just go like,
so could conduct slowly. So does that sort of familiar chord progression, is that also part of what makes this relaxing to the audience? Is it might be something, it might feel familiar to us, and so we're able to relax along with the characters?
I think that has a lot to do with it. I think that's why I always say there's definitely no one way to read music, to analyze music. We, the listener, are trained by, our perceptions are guided by everything that we've been used to hearing. And so same with the drums, like we're used to associating this kind of relaxed, like the strong beats are few and far between. And what we get in between is a lot of like little tender beats, like a lot of them, like, I don't know. It's like a familiar feeling that feels like calmly predictable to people.
What's good too, I feel like, a lot of us standing where Han is standing on this sort of what looks like just a rickety sort of platform
above
nothing, like would be scary to us.
Yeah.
But there is this sense of familiarity and it's comforting, and you know, it's not a scary moment for Han. This is a great moment for Han. And so just the music, it's so funny because just in this, you know, short, probably 20 seconds, like it just shows you how much a composer can sort of get across what you should be feeling.
Exactly. Like music is one of the biggest, music and sound are like, I think the biggest manipulators in movies, honestly. If you scored this a different way and just focused on the shots of like looking over the mountains and seeing how high up they are, like it could be a completely different scene.
Right.
And so this is a good example of how the music can take care of us in the moment and make things that could be read as either very scary or sometimes even very gruesome or very tragic. It can be read as hopeful or something else, even in A New Hope, when we think of like the way that Ben is cut down, or we think of like other tragedies that happen in the movie. It's not that terrible things aren't happening, but the music takes care of us in a way to like move us on.
What it also does is it helps us, because we've had two scenes ago, Han and Chewie were at each other's throat.
Yeah.
They were, even when they escaped the pit, they were trying to go off in separate directions. Mm-hmm. And so they were kind of contentious. Mm-hmm. And then we just get the shower scene and then this scene. And we understand as the audience that they're friends. And this music kind of helps let you know that like, this is kind of a fast friendship, and it's like a big hug. This music is a big hug, which you don't really get in a lot of in Star Wars.
Yeah, that's very perceptive, because also I will say that in the catalog of Star Wars themes, Frank Lehman identifies this, not necessarily the drum part, but at least the melody and the harmony. That, you know, that thing, which I don't have enough keys to fully, as the Han and Chewie motif. In fact, it's not necessarily just the fact that they're Soren, although the orchestration of it and everything has a lot to do with the fact, like it all works there. But when it comes up later, it also is like Han and Chewie. So.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
So good.
Yeah, it's great. So I'm going to play a little bit from Jerry Goldsmith's score called Soren. And I just, let's, listeners, I encourage you to think about what may or may not strike you as similar. Okay, and I'll narrate what happens in the ride. Okay, this is kind of the beginning. You're strapped into this thing. Your legs are dangling. You're being lifted into the air now. There's a big screen in front of you. You see mountains first, or something like that. Basically, you are soaring over the state of California. And now this is the part where you really are like flying. Like the ride moves in a way and the wind kind of, you know, moves past you in the ride in such a way that makes you feel like you are, I don't know, parasailing? I don't know what it's called. Not parasailing. Not parachuting.
It's like hang gliding.
Hang gliding or something, yeah. And you're looking below you at all this beautiful, you know, like pine trees. Like you're in like the mountains. You smell stuff, you know. You're going over oceans, going over Yosemite. It's a really beautiful experience, to be honest.
I really like it when it shifts into the Western. Like there, you see cowboys on horses, and it's same thing, but it dovetails into a Western sound.
Yeah, and so something similar to here is if you think of like the structure of the melody, it is a lot of sustained notes too. Like it almost has the same lilt, right?
Mm-hmm.
1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And in the background, we also hear this sort of, we hear a beat. We hear a constant beat in the background.
Yeah.
This is kind of a change place, but when it gets back to the groove, we hear a constant beat in the background, but it's not like a dunk, 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 dunk. Okay, well, we're about to get back into it. It's like a light. Like we still feel the pulse, but it's just not like hitting you over the head. And it, you almost hear the wind type of, yeah. I mean, this is like one of my, that's probably like my favorite Goldsmith ever. But okay, now let's compare that directly to solo, right? Kind of the same groove, right?
Yeah, the orchestration seems similar too.
It's so similar. Yep.
The brass.
Yep. So, Soren music, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Yeah, I dig it. I dig it a lot. Also, John Powell, much like Jerry Goldsmith, likes to use like electronic percussion. If you listen to the beginning of Soren, that sort of beat has a sort of an electronic sound to it.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like an arpeggiator.
Yeah.
Like a synth of Goldsmith. Some sort.
Yeah, Goldsmith, he really, really liked utilizing electronics mixed with the live orchestra. And so John Powell does very similar, like especially like the Bourne scores, Bourne Identity, Bourne Supremacy, and... Mm-hmm. Less so in the Bourne Ultimatum, but it gives it a unique style. It really does. And I'm glad he brought that into solo. Because I feel like those are electronics, right? Those beats in this track?
They could be.
They could be.
It sounds like it. It sounds like it to me.
Yeah.
Like there is some sort of a... Now here is a... It's not really a twist, but... it's pop. I think what happens behind the scenes in scoring, we never completely know. And John Powell, of course, did have people helping him out. This particular cue might be one that someone else maybe took the lead on, but still, like, he oversees everything. It's not like he would just like let something slide that he didn't co-sign or something, but it is just, that happens. So, I guess we got nice and deep into that conversation.
Yeah, it's a great moment. It's one of my favorite moments. My favorite scene in like almost all of Star Wars is the shower scene, because it's such a great shorthand for what a, like, it shows you what this friendship is right off the bat. Like Chewbacca probably has a tribe where they shower together, you know, at like a waterfall or something, who knows. But the fact that Chewbacca has now accepted Han as a friend, where he's comfortable enough to be part of Han Solo's tribe by just sharing the shower, like it's nothing lurid or anything like that. It's just, we're family now. And it's such a great shorthand to, you know, you don't have to sit there and explain this whole time how they became friends. It's a nice, quick scene. And paired with this scene, it's really great. It just shows that they hit it off right away. And that music definitely ties those scenes together really well.
Yeah.
Really well.
Okay, so let's get into another part that I wanted to bring up, because it's another, I think it's our first instance of another theme that comes up, so.
Okay.
There's no way Infus Nest even knows about this shipment. Only my guy has the intel.
Well, he better be right. Yeah? Because sometimes you put your faith.
It's very soft.
People.
Our whole future depends on that one school. And you
that was it. We only hear hints of it right now, but did you hear, like, in the woodwinds in the back?
It's like a foreboding.
Yeah, it is.
It's almost similar to like a the Emperor's theme. It's very quiet, very menacing.
Yeah, I guess so.
What it's showing that there's danger. It's almost like foreshadowing danger.
Yeah, I think it definitely has like a foreshadowing quality here, especially since it's literally just so softly in the background before we really like. I missed it the first time because it's so soft. Like, I thought it didn't pop up until later. But because when it pops up later, like this theme later, it pops up full orchestra, like, and then it's with the Bulgarian choir. And it's like, you can't miss this theme, but the seed of it has actually been planted like all the way back here in the back of the conversation. So, let's get into it from a little bit earlier, just so we can hear.
On this one, there's no way Infus Nest even knows about this shipment. Only my guy has the intel.
Well, you better be right. Yeah, because sometimes you put your faith in the wrong people.
Our whole future depends on this one school.
Yep.
And you bring in amateurs.
Yep. What's that?
Is that Infus Nest's
yep.
theme?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the chanting.
Yep. That's later funny. On, when I we didn't... hear it later on, we hear it more rhythmically defined. Mm-hmm. So like here, when we hear it more, it's more amorphous, and that's why it is maybe harder to pick up on it. And maybe it feels more foreshadowy because it's slower. It's like before. Yeah. And then later when we hear it, it's definitely much more in a much stricter tempo. It's, you know, do, 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 do,
That feels pretty unique for a Star Wars theme to me. It doesn't sound like Williams, which is nice.
Yeah, that's because it is basically Balkan. It's basically Bulgarian music. Yeah. It's written in definitely not like a Western modality. It's it's definitely I'm going to try to I'm like nervous. I'm always nervous to talk to like former teachers, but I studied Balkan music, like musicology in grad school. And, I'm half Greek, so I have studied a lot of Greek music and played a lot of it. And dipped into like Bulgarian music and all this stuff too. And I really want to have her, I really want to ask my former teacher on, my former professor on the show. I don't know if she's a Star Wars fan, but she would be able to like talk about Bulgarian, like Bulgarian women's choirs in particular. Like she taught me so much about that whole world that I feel like it would be like a necessary discussion to have in the context of this film.
Right. I don't think she would have to be a Star Wars fan.
Oh, I know. I think it would be an important.
I own so many soundtrack albums to movies I've never seen before, and I just love them on their own, to the point where when I actually watch the movies, I'm like, oh, this isn't how I thought it was going to go. But yeah, that sounds like a great discussion.
Yeah.
I'd like to know more because of all the themes in this movie, Enfys Nest stands out to me the most.
Yeah. And I think
it sounds the most unique, I think, for a Star Wars movie.
Yeah. And I think in order to analyze it, I think we need to have like a perspective that is not just from the like Western music theory perspective, but I think we need to have the perspective also from someone who understands like and lives in more of the Bulgarian side of things.
I wouldn't be nervous about it. I think it's,
I know, I'm like nervous about talking to a Thor. Like, I know.
I think you'll be fine.
Yeah. I need to just, this is like therapy. I'm feeling bolder, you know, like, dear professor, blah, blah, blah. I was in your class 3 years ago. And I was really inspired by, I have this show called Star Wars Music Minute. It's a pretty specific type of show, but it's okay. You don't have to. Anyway, yeah, it's an interesting pitch. But anyway, so here, yeah, of course, this is the Enfys Nest. This is the first Enfys Nest theme that will come up much bigger in the next set of minutes. And then also toward the end of the movie, of course, when we meet Enfys Nest. That's wanted to touch upon that. And of course that happens when Val and Beckett are kind of talking about bringing Han and Chewie on board with their plan. And, they bring up Enfys Nest. And at this point, we don't even know what Enfys Nest is. Like it doesn't even sound like it's the name of a person. It's just like, it's this looming, like, I don't know, threat, competitor, something that they're concerned about. But, we just don't know much about. And so,
but the thing is, the music's great because it'll let you know, oh, that's who they were talking about before.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of it's the composer. Like I've seen it a lot. You'll see it in there's a James Bond movie called The World Is Not Enough where, somebody says something and in the music, there's a little piano do-do-do-do-do that just plays under that thing. You don't notice it. But then when the bad guy says it later, the same thing, he goes do-do-do-do-do again in the score. And you're like, oh, wait, she said that too. So they're together.
Yeah.
So this kind of, it's nice, this foreshadowing. It just lets you know something's coming. You hear it in the music. And then finally later you get the sort of reveal. This is what we were talking about earlier. I don't know how composers do it.
Well,
it's so like just laying the track and telling the story musically, you know, it's really, for me, it's super exciting. It's super exciting. Cause I went and watched these minutes. You sent me the link. I watched the minutes immediately. I watched them again today. And I never picked up on that until you just pointed it out. But I guarantee you my brain knew about it when I watched it the first time and then every time since.
Which I think is like the ideal circumstance. I think when things become so obvious that it's like, I don't know, it feels a little bit... and of course... This is a spectrum, and for some people it's very exciting and some people are just more sensitive to when things are really obvious. So your mileage may vary, but like when I hear something that's such an overt reference that it doesn't feel subconsciously special anymore, it just makes me feel maybe kind of infantilized as an audience member a little bit. Like, wow, you think I need it that much? Like, but I don't necessarily represent everyone, but
it's tough. It's tough. Like I've been listening to film score since I was four. That's 41 years now. Cause I'm 45. I just turned 45. Every movie I go to, I try really hard not to pay attention to the score. And if they do it right, I don't pay attention to the score. So there's certain things where it's tough because I love the music so much, but sometimes it could be distracting. And I feel like it's probably more on my shoulders than the composer's shoulders, because I feel like the majority of people don't pay attention to music as much as I do. But sometimes something will just get under my skin. And it usually, I mean, again, I don't want to bring up Hans Zimmer, but there's some stuff that gets done where I'm like, why are you doing that? And I'll like sit there and like analyze the music instead of just watching the film.
Yeah. I mean, we all have like our sort of pet peeves and things that we pay attention to. And sometimes we don't pay attention to them until we realize it's even a thing. And then we can't stop noticing it. Like there are tons of those things with me where it maybe wasn't a big deal until like something tipped me over the edge. And then I just can't stop hearing it that way. And it doesn't just happen with music. It happens visually. It happens with, you know, stylistically, right, with writing. It happens with any, like kind of, it's almost, the, yeah.
It's the example is this. So I grew up watching Star Wars my whole life. Mm-hmm. I have copies of the VHS tapes sitting here.
Oh, good. I got a fan on the show.
I didn't notice the stormtrooper hitting his head in the Death Star until I saw it on the big screen in 97 for the special edition.
Steel and Saunders now, would have a bone to pick with you.
And now that's all I see. So there's just certain things that once you see them, you can't unsee them. And so it's tough. It's tough, especially when music is played throughout. You just hope you don't get distracted by it. It happened during Rogue One, but I was sort of waiting for something to happen. And then when it did, I got so excited.
Are you talking about the Imperial theme? Yeah, I know that.
Yeah.
I know you like
that one. And what's funny is the minutes you picked for me on this episode is like right after my favorite scene, which is the shower scene. So I'm glad I got to talk about that. But then also coming up is the train heist, which has that Imperial theme. And I kind of hope I could just, I just want to bring it up just a slight bit.
Okay, you're allowed. Okay.
Okay. But so look forward to this in the next couple episodes.
Yeah.
During the train heist, as soon as the range trooper, the stormtroopers set, there's a shot of them setting their foot on the train on the outside. They step into frame. Mm-hmm. John Powell plays the old Imperial theme from 1977.
I know what you're talking about.
So it's one of my favorite themes. I don't know why. I think is just because it was only really in the 77 Star Wars. So it's super nostalgic for me, and it never appeared again until Rogue One and Solo. And then also in Rebels, and I think in Bad Batch as well. Mm-hmm. But it's funny that you knew I was going to have to talk about that stupid theme again. Yeah. I love it. I love it.
I know. Different guests, different Star Wars people I know have different. Yeah.
That's my thing.
It's sort of like when I used to work at a restaurant, I would creepily remember everyone's order.
It happens. I worked in retail, and you just know what people are looking for because you start getting into the rhythm of things again. You start getting comfortable and settle in and everything.
Well, I don't know what your order at this restaurant is, thankfully. So, but I know what theme you like. So,
that's the thing I order is anytime I hear that theme, I get so excited and I'll tweet about it. And it's because it's a thing that was created the same year I was born and then like abandoned. And so it's like a brother to me. So every time I hear it, it's like, oh,
are you the same age as Star Wars? Wait,
I'm 3 months older than Star Wars. I was born in February.
That's so cool.
February 77. So,
wow.
Yeah, I know.
That's a cool claim to fame. Yeah, that's cool. That's sure. Very cool.
Yeah, I'm an old man.
No. Okay, we're now like, there's not going to be music for a while, but there is one thing that I want to talk about, and it's Rio's voice. So,
okay,
let's just hear a little bit of that.
Putting our lives in the hands of morons.
You guys morons?
No.
No. See?
We're not morons. Look, I waited a long time for a shot like this. I'm not about to screw it up, all right?
Here we go.
Oh, come on, Val. He looks so sincere. Plus, have you ever tried to disinvite a Wookiee to anything? Not a good idea.
This is not funny.
Look, I have great instincts about these guys. And
I want to keep hearing till the end of this one line.
Any other options?
I just hope you know what you're doing.
I know exactly what I'm doing and why. We're going to clear our debts. Go back to Gleon's home. And I'm finally going to learn how to
hear
play
that fire in the background.
I'm never going to learn how to play the Valacord.
She's right. You are tone deaf.
So what's your sob story, Flyboy?
Oh, me?
You're after something. I know the look. What is it? Revenge?
No, it's not revenge. Look at him. If it's anything, it's a girl.
Oh, a girl. Tell us about the girl, Han. Is she nice?
So, the way that the audio, the way that the dialogue is mixed, mm-hmm. it feels like it's all coming from the same place.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a little bit distracting for me.
What I think is strange when I watch these minutes is that I almost expected the Kira theme to show up at some point during this conversation. It feels like a natural place when he's not saying why he's doing it and Val figures it out. I feel like that would be a spot where you would drop in music, but the fact that they don't, it's pretty nice. I feel like, especially with the prequels, there might be too much music going on. Like there's not really a lot of time to breathe where it's just conversation and it's quiet. Even the conversation between like Qui-Gon Jinn and Boss Nass, like you're still getting sort of music in the background. So for Star Wars to have a scene where it's just talking and the only sounds you get is talking and campfire is pretty rare. But I mean, I feel like this was done on a set and they probably recorded the audio for the actors and they got it pretty cleanly. But, Jon Favreau probably did his lines after the fact. And so I feel like they try to mix it so his levels sounded like he was with them. So it all has sort of a kind of even tone.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't think it sounds like he's with them, though. I think something about it sounds...
No, I think they're trying to.
Yeah, no, I know.
Yeah.
And maybe, and yeah. So slight possibly rebuttal. I don't think it's that unusual to hear dialogue without music in Star Wars. But also, I haven't gone through all of the movies with the same fine-tooth comb that I have with these few.
I guess one of the things that's sort of different about the scene, I guess, would be, and it's not necessarily just the music is always there, but there's usually always sound. So like when you have the scene in the Millennium Falcon with Obi-Wan and Luke with the training remote, there's no music during that scene, but you're still getting the hum of the ship. You're still getting the chessboard pieces in the background.
I see. You're getting active sound design, basically.
Yeah. And this one, I mean... Usually you would get like either a wind howl or something, but this is like literally just dialogue and the fireplace and then whatever pots and pans you hear in the background. It's such a quiet scene.
Maybe what it is, because it's not quiet because we do have the crackle technically. And then later on,
right.
Beckett does a spin with his pistol and that has sound to it. And there's like the sound of them doing stuff at the campfire. But I think maybe what it is it sounds... This could be not a Star Wars movie. Maybe it just sounds like, maybe it's just the difference between it just being a campfire scene, any old campfire scene with any old pistol or like, you know, this is, could be from any movie here with the exception of like of Rio's appearance. But maybe that's it. Like, maybe it's like not hearing the hum of a ship or a lightsaber or something like that. I don't know. But something about it just feels... I'm a little bit taken out in this scene. And also, I don't know what it is. Like, I don't know what it is. It could be any element. It could be any element that is subconscious. I just don't know exactly what it is. It could be the acting. you know, the more characters you add where you're like, you're acting two things where it's not all, not all the elements are there at the same time. Like, you know, Chewie's voice isn't entirely there. Rio's voice isn't probably entirely there when they're, and Rio's appearance isn't entirely there when their actors are shooting. Right. Like, I don't know what went on in the scene, but something about the scene feels forced to me. I don't know. It just, I feel a little bit taken out of it. Also, I want to call attention to they name the Valacord, a Star Wars instrument. The Valacord. Now, this is interesting because I believe we have never heard the Valacord being played. And so I like went on this deep dive of what does this thing look like? What the hell is it? And I'm sure, I have no doubt that at probably Alex on Star Wars Minute will probably open up his visual guide and probably show the audience when that episode comes out. But I did look up some photos, and this instrument, like, first of all, I just have an inherent fascination with all Star Wars instruments. Like, I want to see them. Like, I want to hear them in action. I want to see how they work and how they play. I want to see if there's diegetic music associated with them. I want to see if it lines up with the actual construction of the instrument. Like, you know, like in the Cantina Band, like you can look up all those instruments and I can listen to the Cantina Band track and I can think like, okay, the one that sounds like a clarinet is the one that looks like that. The one that sounds like this is the instrument that, you know, looks like that. All the other stuff is this other instrument, the band fill or whatever, because it is so, or the Omnibox, because it can kind of do electronics and stuff. So I'll, you know, like, I try to match that kind of stuff up. And so with the Valacord, there's like, I have pretty much no reference for it, but so trying to think about what it looks like. Also, if I ever cosplay one day, I definitely will go as something, someone that plays something. So I just want to know what instruments I can pick from. So if you're watching on YouTube, I've put up a little picture of concept art for the Valacord. And I think, did Phil, I don't know how to say his last name. I don't know how to say it. You know what I mean? It starts with an S. Yeah. I'll put the link in the show notes. Either he made this or someone else did, but I got it from one of his tweets, I believe. And I think it's in the book. But okay, what it looks like, and I'll try to describe this for listeners. It looks like a gigantic harp, but with two sets of strings, but there are also keys. Oh, I think Matthew Savage may have done this concept art. Okay, there are also keys, like as if you were going to press like a piano or something. But there are also like two long barrels that look kind of like an alpine horn, like an alp horn.
Right.
So I am just, I have so many questions about what is going on here. I've just put up another picture. So,
oh, it's huge.
Crap, man, that's, okay.
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So, but I'd never seen the Valacord before. Yeah. I assumed it was also a harp type instrument just because I think it says cord and I associate chords with strings.
Yep.
But I thought it would be more like a handheld, one of those little,
like a Celtic wires. Harp, small thing.
Yeah. But I like that. It's kind of cool. It does have a sort of maybe a piano thing to it. I didn't realize it had keys.
Yeah.
And maybe the strings, you know how you used to play telephone with tin cans?
Yeah.
Maybe the strings vibrate and the sound travels through those tubes and out the alpine horn.
Mm, okay.
So maybe the keys strike the strings and then the sound comes out of the openings. Maybe that's it. Because the way it's crossed, the strings look like they crisscross, and that would be impossible to play. Like plucking the strings, but with the keys, you can hit them with hammers and the sound, I think, would travel through the horn.
You're right. It does look like they crisscross, and I don't think it would be impossible to pluck them if you stay above the part where it crosses, but if you plucked it too, it would have to be set in such a way that if you plucked at maximum strength, the vibrations wouldn't end up like hitting each other. Like they wouldn't vibrate so big that that the strings touch each other. So there would have to be adequate clearance. I am dying. Like This I instrument, hear it. I need to hear this instrument. I need it.
It looks really cool.
I know. I can't.
Yeah, those strings 100% have to crisscross.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. And he's got foot pedals.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, listeners, I look up this part on YouTube. We're at the, I think, like hour and 5 minute mark. Look up on YouTube or look up concept art by Matthew Savage. It shows like a creature playing this instrument, and it's so many things, you know, like it could be a wind instrument. Like you could pluck it. You could maybe press keys that do something. You can do it with things with two hands, but it also looks like sound probably comes out of the bottom, like an Alpine horn, which is like the Ricola commercials. Ricola. Like I just have so many questions about what this sounds like and what you can do with it. And because it looks so complicated and so big, like first of all, the fact that it's so big, like immediately tells me that it must be incredibly resonant and loud. Because it's just physics, right? You have a big body of an instrument and a big space for the, you know, that's like, it's a big resonance chamber. It probably makes a big sound. I'm imagining some sort of a harp. Now, maybe the pedals indicate that maybe you can either use the foot pedals to switch up tuning or use the foot pedals to either dampen strings or use the foot pedals to either sustain strings for a longer ring out or something.
I think you can't see his left foot, but they have, it looks like you could maybe have a pedal on either side.
Yeah. And it looks so like you possibly can maybe
dampening or sustaining.
Yeah, and it looks like you can maybe use one side to pluck the strings and the other side to press keys. Like
you have options.
Yeah, it makes me think that maybe this is just like one of those instruments, you know, like when the one man band stuff started happening, when you have like all the instruments on basically in one, and also even the drum kit, it was created sort of as a way to like have all these instruments in one package. This might be one of those multifaceted instruments where you can play it like a harp, you can play it like a piano, or you could play it like a horn. Like maybe you can do all of those things. I don't know. I need to hear it.
I feel like I'm looking at it. I feel like it would sound like a mix between a harp, piano, and like didgeridoo.
Yeah.
Like a piano sort of nice string sound, but have that sort of whoa sound that goes along with it. I don't know. It's cool looking. I'd never seen one before right now. And 100% need to hear what it sounds like.
Yeah, I would say I agree with that. I would say maybe instead of a piano, it probably sounds more like a harpsichord, because the harpsichord predated the piano. The piano is actually an amazing technological invention, but prior to the piano, there was this thing called the harpsichord or the clavichord, things basically where it looks kind of like a piano on the outside, but inside of the box, instead of having a hammer that hits the strings, which is what a piano does, it was like this little hook that when you press a string, there's like a hook that plucks the string. So it's kind of like a proto harp. So that's why when you hear harpsichord music, you don't have the same like dynamic. It's not as smooth and fluid and dynamic as a piano. It only has like basically one sound, one level, cause it's plucking something. It's harder to play when you play a harpsichord. I mean, they're rare to find, but if you basically go to like music school and there's harpsichords and, you know, people playing new music in Baroque ensembles and stuff like that. And I believe there was someone who played a Baroque musician, I think may have played the valichord in this movie, but it didn't make it into the movie. But like, it was never something that we heard. It was something like, just to on screen playing basically, like just the appearance. So yeah, I think those keys might not, I don't see any hammers to hit the strings, but maybe those keys are plucking the string like a harpsichord. I don't know.
That's great. I never knew how a harpsichord worked before right now.
Yeah. That's harpsichords so cool. Are so wild. I mean,
yeah,
really the piano.
Is there a harpsichord played in Jabba's Baroque music?
Oh,
If it's anywhere in Star Wars, if there's a harpsichord in Star Wars, that would be the one spot it would be in.
There's something that sounds like a harpsichord. Right. I don't know exactly what it is, though. But yes, I
feel like the name Valacor brings up like sort of imagery of harpsichord. Like it sounds,
yeah, it
like
does.
That's what it would sound like. So I feel like you're right in the fact that it probably sounds more like a harpsichord.
Yeah. Okay. By the way, I looked it up, and Jabba's Baroque recital has a synthesized harpsichord. So
okay.
Yeah, sort of, but yeah. But anyway, yeah, maybe in the future I'll have to talk about how amazing the piano is. The piano is an incredible invention. I just watched
a video on YouTube about the piano. It's a channel called, it's Mark Rober. And he created essentially a talking piano. He filled a piano with all kinds of electronics to make so where it would play like 10 keys at a time to synthesize what a human voice sounds like.
Oh, interesting.
But it's an actual player piano. It's not a synthesizer. Oh, it's curious. Nuts. Just if you look up YouTube, I'm sure you just look up talking piano. I think you'll get a kick out of it because it also shows you how the piano is constructed and the inner workings to press a key and the mechanics used for the hammer to hit the string is, I don't know how the piano was ever invented. I really don't.
Yeah. It's,
it's amazing. Super complicated.
It's amazing.
It's super complicated.
Yeah. Pianos are just incredible instruments,
man. Yeah. I had a whole new respect for the piano after watching that video.
Yeah. So the track, the next music that comes in is on the soundtrack. You'll find it under the name Train Heist, or if you are on the deluxe version of the album, it'll be called Deluxe Train Heist. I mean, the deluxe version is longer because it includes more cues, but the beginning is still going to be the same. So the music that pops in is not Han and Kira's mute theme, but it's Han talking about, there was a girl, he says, am I talking about the right track? Did I name the right track? I think I'm naming the right track.
Train Heist is the one that has the classic Imperial theme that I love so much. I've listened to Train Heist so much.
Yeah, that was not it. But yeah, so what happens? Okay, I'll let me just pull it up here.
We pretty much end our minutes at Han getting his signature blaster.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's
so
two big moments. There's two big moments in these 5 minutes that you gave me.
There was a
girl. One, but Chewbacca. We get Chewbacca's name, and B, we get Han Solo's blaster.
True.
Yeah.
So this is the music.
I'd become a pilot. Get a ship. Go back and find her.
So it's pretty.
Right,
quote unquote classic underscore.
How do you know she'll still be there?
It's not supposed to be. Oh, Rio's voice that just popped in there. I was like, where did that come from? But anyway, you know, there was one more thing I wanted to say about the Valacord, and that is the line. This is just a little nitpick about the writing here. Rio says, or Val's like, babe, you're never going to learn how to play the Valacord. And Rio's like, she's right. You are tone deaf. I just have a little nitpick about that line. And
yeah.
First of all, tone deafness is... True tone deafness is rare, and it shows that Rio doesn't have an understanding of what it takes to play music, because if you consider quote unquote tone deafness, which in the way it's usually used in a way not talking about music. It's usually used in talking about politicians or people who are not reading the room or something like that. Obviously an ableist way to put that. And here it's just to play something where you press keys, you wouldn't even need that much specificity in your like ability to distinguish between pitches. Like it wouldn't be like it would be harder to sing than it would be to accurately play the Valacord, put it that way, because or to play the violin, like there's no frets. You have to go completely, like you would have to train your ear to be able to distinguish between pitches, but to play something where there are defined keys, like a piano or like something where you pluck, it is different. You actually, as long as you know where to put your fingers, you wouldn't, it would be okay if you didn't have the best pitch. It would be okay. You wouldn't actually, you wouldn't need it. Yeah. You would need it to sing, yes, but not to necessarily play the valley chord. So that's just my little nitpick. Yeah.
As soon as I heard that line, I was like, oh, this is opening a big can of worms. I know it. Yeah. I know it.
Yeah.
I'm like, what does playing an instrument have to do with being tone deaf? It doesn't. Yeah. I always associate
depending
tone
on
deaf
the instrument
with, singing.
Yeah. But, it depends on the instrument. With some instruments, you need it. Like I play piano and I play violin. On piano, it's the one thing that I never, ever have to worry about is tuning. On the violin, that is a major, major part of playing violin is honing your tuning and working on tuning and getting things in tune and playing in tune. On piano or on guitar, once your instrument is already at a baseline level of being tuned, which on piano, you might update the way a piano is tuned like every couple years or something, like, and a professional would just come and tune it in one fell. Mm-hmm. So like once it's already calibrated, you don't worry about tuning. You just worry about playing the, you know, things. Now it would impact things like whether you can play by ear and figure out new things, but just having to mechanically like press the right notes and practice the patterns of the notes, you wouldn't need, you wouldn't need it. And just looking at the way the valley chord looks, I'm just assuming. So I don't know for sure, except for the part where you are blowing into the horn, perhaps. I don't think you would need that much pitch accuracy. Plus when you play music, like maybe Beckett is quote unquote tone deaf right now. But when you, that's the thing, when you start learning an instrument, that's how you hones your ear. You don't have to have like amazing pitch to just try playing an instrument. You learn on the job. Like that's how you grow. You don't have to already, you know? So I wouldn't want someone listening to this to ever not try playing an instrument because you don't have a honed ear yet. Like that is actually something that that most people can work on, that you can get better on. It's not a fixed, you know, just like if you listen to this podcast, I don't know. Hopefully if I've done my job okay, like hopefully you are already can pick up on more things than you were before.
Yeah.
This is not fixed. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, so you were right. Can of worms. Okay. Moving on. I mean, those are the main notes I had about these minutes. Did you have something else to add?
I don't think so. This is the perfect middle of the sandwich for me as far as what's to come and what has happened before. And I think I touched on both. I think Solo is one of my favorite Star Wars movies. Maybe number three.
After
Star Wars and Empire. There's something about the movie that I just really enjoy, and I think it's not shrouded in mystery. It's not really shrouded in like there's not a whole lot of character development. On the surface, it's just an action adventure movie with elements of heist movies, with elements of westerns, and it just is like, here's a story from A to B. And it just happens to have Han Solo and Chewbacca in the center of it. And that's it. It offers some world building, but it doesn't really affect too much. It's a blip on the radar of the grander scope of the Skywalker saga. It doesn't really affect anything between the Empire or the Rebels. It's just, I just like it for being a fun adventure movie. And that's really what I like about the original Star Wars from 1977. It was an adventure movie. There wasn't the characters are pretty much their archetypes, and they don't really have huge arcs. Han Solo, who's the smuggler, does end up having the Heart of Gold and helping the rebellion. But like Princess Leia from beginning to end is like, you know who she is. Luke Skywalker, you know who he is. So I liked that about Star Wars. Even though I love all the Star Wars movies, like there's something in the sequel trilogy that I'm not really into the whole, oh, who's her parents? Oh, who's, you know, it's that kind of stuff. it gets too deep. Like, it should just be an adventure movie, a fun adventure movie that should be taken sort of not too seriously. They're for fun. They're for fun. And for me, Solo is like just for fun. It's not really offensive. It's not soiling years of Legends books or new canon books or anything. It's just this adventure that's sitting off to the side that you can just kick back and just watch. And, you know, I feel like even though you can nitpick a lot of stuff, I feel like this movie's the least nitpicky because the story is just, it's just a fun adventure.
Yeah. Like it's sort of harder to critique because it's not trying to be anything more than it is, basically.
Right. Right.
I appreciate you sharing that perspective and sharing your like excitement for this movie with me, because this is my least favorite Star Wars movie.
And that's the thing. I get it.
It just, different people look for different things in Star Wars, and that's obviously okay. So I enjoyed talking to you about this.
There's no wrong ranking of Star Wars movies.
Of course.
Yeah.
Speaking of ranking, this is a good time to transition to the Star Wars Music Minute questionnaire.
All right. I'm excited.
All right. So in exactly three words, what does Star Wars sound like?
So here's the thing. I can, for me, it's two words, but I'll add a third word at the top here. Cause I would say, I'll say old and lived in.
Mm.
Like there's something about the Star Wars sounds that I always feel. How about instead of old, how about organic? I'll say organic, lived in.
Sounds because,
I always love that Ben Burtt went and got the sounds, like created the sounds from things here on Earth, but sounded otherworldly. He didn't use synthesizers to create a lot of the sounds. So they have a real tactile feel. So well, they feel did, really but not lived in.
Entirely.
Yeah.
I totally know what you mean. And that's a good way to put that. Question number two, what is something related to Star Wars music or sound that you're interested in or want to learn more about?
Well, now it's the Valacord. I'll say this, because when you brought up the Cantina band and trying to figure out what instruments did what sounds, now I'm really interested, because I'm a huge fan of the source music in Star Wars, the diegetic music. And it's always interesting to hear new takes on what that is. So I think now I want to know what the real world instruments are that went into making those, that music, like you're going to come up to Chicken in the Pot soon, and take all the Earth instruments that took to creating that track. And then saying, okay, this is the Star Wars equivalent of the guitar. This is the Star Wars equivalent to a synthesizer. This is a, you know, and I want a full like database of instruments, a one for one, like Arabesh. You know what? A is this symbol, B is this symbol, C is this symbol. I want that, but for Earth instruments and what they are in Star Wars.
This sounds like a project for Auric Fons and me. So, who is the guest? So harp, gonna be the guest harp for Chicken is
Valacord, or harpsichord is Valacord.
Well, something like that. Yes. But the Valacord seems, I'm interested in it too. The Valacord seems like it's so much more. I want to hear this glorious instrument. And then maybe
I want to be able to do
one
orchestration.
Day pay someone to recreate it for me so I can, like, I'm just a simple Star Wars musician that I just want to know these things. I don't need canonically the instruments to all line up to Earth instruments. I don't need that. I understand that there are creative liberties and jumps to be made. But just from the perspective of someone who wants to learn how to play some of these Star Wars instruments, I just want to know. I just want to know, practically speaking, how I can do this.
But the thing that intrigues me the most is the future of Star Wars music. With Michael Giacchino, John Powell, and Ludwig Göransson coming in.
Okay.
Like, I'm interested to see other composers take now that the floodgates have opened.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm most intrigued about is the future of Star Wars music.
I'm going to put both of those as your answer. Yeah.
Okay.
Sounds good. And finally, this is going to be hard for you. What's a score or soundtrack that you're fond of besides anything Star Wars?
So this is what I've decided to do because I have a library of, I want to say it's like 28 days worth of music.
That's why I say film, what is a score, not the favorite. Less pressure.
So this is what I decided as far as this question goes is this score is composed by John Powell, and not a lot of people may not be familiar with John Powell. So I am going to let you know my favorite John Powell score, and it's wildly different from Solo, and it's wildly different from his famous scores like the Bourne movies and
How to Train Your Dragon.
It's Evolution. It's a movie called Evolution. It was a comedy starring David Duchovny from Ivan Reitman. And what's nice about it has sort of everything in it. Mm-hmm. It has like military marches, comedic cues, like Western guitar, like acoustic guitar. It's kind of all over the place, but it's so full of joy and adventure that it's my favorite John Powell score. And it's not even a good representation of what he does, but I just enjoy it so much.
That's so funny. Evolution. That's funny.
I guarantee you nobody was expecting that on the show.
I wasn't expecting it, but I just listened to it like last month because I'm trying to listen to his whole discography. Mm-hmm. And so since that's sort of at the beginning of the discography, that was one of the first Powell scores that I actually ended up listening to. Cool. Well, before we get to where to find you, I want to recap the themes that we heard in this set of minutes. We heard Han and Chewie and Enfys Nest 1. The tracks that we heard were the end of Flying with Chewie, also known as Chewie Untamed, same music, and the beginning of the track called Train Heist or Deluxe Train Heist. So where can people find you online, Ralph?
I do a lot of stuff. So you can go to casinoskunk.com. But if you're here for Star Wars, which I'm pretty sure you are, head over to liveactionstarwars.com. Me and my co-host James discuss everything Star Wars related that's live action. Everything. And then this is Franz, who's been very, very kind.
Your cat's been your cat's been so good in the background there. Well, thank you so much for coming on Star Wars.
Thanks for having me.
It was really fun talking to you.
I rarely get to talk about scores, so I'm glad I'm able to do this. Thank you so much.
And thank you. It was you added a lot to the conversation and to my understanding of the scene. So, yay.
And I now know what a harpsichord is.
Yeah. That's a good deep dive to go down. And listeners, we'll be back next week. You can find me online at the usual places. I'll put all the links in the show notes. And next week we'll be tackling minutes 31 through 35, getting into the train heist. With that, may the force be with you. See you next week on Star Wars Music Minute.